Chapter 14. Kabarjarir Garade Jagisade Kotla Adalishade Kotlasha. Train your sons to be strong, but your daughters to be stronger. Mandalorian saying. Zarya's Bar, Drawl, Corellian System. Mandalore, said a voice Fett didn't recognize. Galgala. The soldier took off his Mandalorian helmet and gave Fett a stiffly formal nod. A baby's handprint in charcoal paint adorned the helmet of his gray-blue armor, a curious foil for the verpine rifle slung over his left shoulder.
This is Rom, said Bevin. Rom Zarabar. He's our star sniper for those delicate jobs.
Zarabar nodded politely. Fett wanted to ask about the handprint, but didn't. Myrta gave Fett one of her subtly admonishing looks. He was attuned to them now.
"And he says he wants to buy you a drink," she said.
"Later," Fett returned Zaramar's nod. "Not even my own men see me without the helmet. Let's talk first." There was nothing like half a dozen fully armored Mandalorian warriors to guarantee you a table to yourself in a crowded bar. Bevin introduced them. Zaramar, Breeka, Orade, Veivut, and Talgal, the only woman, and one who looked as if she ate Yuuzhan Vong for appetizers. Apart from Bevin, none had fought with him against the Vong, and he didn't know them. He studied their faces while they looked suspiciously at Myrta. "Bounty hunter," said Fett. "Myrta Gev, Mandalorian father." They thawed instantly. Fett watched their shoulders relax. They all muttered, "Sukui Gar," like a chorus. It was a pretty logical greeting for warriors, apparently. "So you're still alive." Warriors didn't expect much from life, and they frequently didn't get it. "So how do you feel about defending Centerpoint Station?" Fett asked. There was a disinterested silence. He watched them chew it over for 5 seconds, and he suspected they'd have spat it out like rotting meat if he hadn't been Mandalore. Orade, buzz-cut blonde hair, broken nose, a brush of gold beard on the point of his chin, folded his arms on the table and made a fresh scrape in the polished surface.
"What do you think?"
"I think Sal Solo is a self-serving, sadistic liar. But then most of my customers are. He's also going to lose, and losers can't pay. Actually, I can't be bothered. I've got bigger things on my plate. But I'll hear him out. How do you feel about it?"
"Unenthusiastic," said Veivut.
Another stranger. He had long black woolly braids bound with gold rings, and the dark skin of his left cheek was scored by an impressive scar. He drained his ale and clicked his fingers at a nearby droid.
"Maybe we wait and see before we commit ourselves."
"If you really thought it was worth it, you'd get the whole 100 behind you, Mandalore," said Bevin. "But I'm with Veivut. Wait and see. Things have changed since the Vong invasion."
Veivut turned in his seat, armor creaking to look meaningfully at the service droid. It lurched toward him.
"Yeah, we're not so desperate for work. Farms keep us busy enough."
"Sir," said a droid's voice, "sorry to keep you."
"About time. I'd like another ale."
The droid pirouetted, reflections of the bar's garish lighting bouncing off its polished dome, and tilted as if bowing.
"I am Fore Musa, an artist droid dedicated to your entertainment," said the droid.
"I'd rather have another ale," said Veivut,
voice low. Myrta's eyes kept darting toward the doors. Fett's peripheral vision never lost sight of her hands.
"But what kind of entertainment?"
"Oh,
"'It's of the highest intellectual quality, sir,' Furi Musa said. "'I can read you important works of political allegory, "'comments on current affairs with a unique perspective, "'great literature, all my own work, of course, and sagas. "'What's it to be?'
"'We'd rather hear some jokes,' said Myrta.
"'I don't do jokes. I am a serious artist.' "'Myrta raised her blaster. "'Shame,' she said, and fried his speech circuit with one clean point-blank shot. "'We could do with a laugh.' The bar hung on one silent second as the fizz of shorting circuitry cut through the buzz of conversation. Then everyone went on drinking. Vevoot and the others roared with laughter. Myrta appeared to have passed their test of destructive humor. Even the dobby bartender seemed pleased. He rearranged the glasses and polished one thoughtfully, while his other pair of arms rummaged in a drawer and pulled out an insurance claim flimsy.
"'I'm glad you did that,' he said, scribbling happily on the form, while also working up a good shine on the glass. "'He was killing trade here. The droid company wouldn't give me a refund.'
"'Glad to help the local economy,' said Myrta.
"'Free ale all around.'
"'I like her,' Vevoot said. "'Then teach her to play Chegg,' said Fett. He indicated the Chegg table in the center of the bar. "'I want to talk to Bevin.'
Chegg was a remarkably noisy, violent pursuit for a tabletop game. Fett watched for a few moments as Myrta caught on to the rules rather too fast, whacking the small puck across the tabletop with her knuckles as she shoulder-charged Orade for possession of it.
"'It's okay. I told them to stay off the subject of Aelin's bounty in front of her,' said Bevin. "'So how did you pick up a stray? Never known you to do that.'
"'She offered to lead me to Aelin because she's done a job for her.'
"'You can find Aelin easy enough on your own.' "'Solo's been seen on Corellia. All you have to do is wait.
"'The kid's got my wife's necklace. I want to find out how.'
Fett wondered whether now was the time to come clean with Bevin about his illness. But he decided yet again that it could wait. And some other personal stuff I'm interested in.
"'You like that kid?'
"'I ought to space her.' She spent the flight here beating me up for being a rotten Mandalore.
So she's not blind.
You got a problem with the way I do things?
Yeah, and so have a few others now. Don't get me wrong, nobody's after the job. Nobody that I know, anyway. But the Vong War was a wake-up call. We need more than a symbol.
Mandalores aren't administrators. Mandalorians can run their own communities, anywhere. They just need... "'general leadership when it's called for.'
"'Well, maybe it's called for now.
"'Everyone's still rebuilding across the galaxy, and it's time we did, too.'
"'Fett sat with his hands flat on the table. "'He could hear the guffaws of laughter and occasional exclamations "'in a language he should have understood, but didn't.
"'Mandalore's still in one piece, so is the rest of the sector.
"'Just, and you don't spend much time there.'
"'A lot of Mondos don't,' Fett said.
"'They're not the Mandalore.'
"'Why does this matter now?'
"'People get an idea and start to think differently. It spreads. We lost a lot of people in the war. Makes everyone think hard, that does.'
"'Ask me straight. Don't hint.'
"'Come home and help our people.'
"'How?'
"'Shisa pulled us together once. Now it's time for you to do the same.'
"'I'm a soldier. The war is over. And I'm dying. I'm the one who might need to find a new Mandalore, not you. You need someone who can run an economy.
Then what's the use of being Mandalore? No heir, no clan, no sense of duty. You're not Mandalorian. You just wear the armor.
It was a dangerous retort, but Bevin didn't seem to care. Fett didn't even take it as a challenge. Just a Mandalorian's forthright view that he felt fully entitled to express. There had always been a Mandalore, chief of clans, the leader anointed by the last Mandalore.
or the one who snatched the title from him, always on his deathbed, which was invariably in combat. The ancient mask that was the Mandalore's mark of rank was always at risk. Maybe it's obvious I'm dying. Maybe they're looking for who'll lead them next. You're saying I should be a conventional head of state. We don't have a state like that.
These days we might need one.
Get a bureaucracy and sit in meetings and get slow and flabby like every other world?
There's more to it than that, and you know it.
It was oddly difficult to take offense at Bevin.
We need to make sure we're warriors with a citadel to defend, so we can pick our battles and not rely on the whims of our Rue Tisse. Foreigners, it's the spirit of the times, like I said.
It didn't sound crazy put that way, but Fat felt it had nothing to do with him. Mandalorians were defined by family above all else, and that was one thing he'd sought and never found after his father was killed. I tried. Sintas, my journeyman protector days. Thinking about his estranged family was painful, but remembering why he'd been exiled from conquered Dawn was something he couldn't allow himself to do. He locked down his emotions. Death really messes you up. He was alone. He was fine that way. Bevin seemed to be waiting for a reply. "And who's driving this spirit of the times?" Fett asked.
"Nobody, really," said Bevin. "But there's this guy called Kadika that we're all hearing about. Thinks it's time we looked after ourselves, really looked after ourselves. Not just gather in the clans and unite when we're threatened, but build Mandalore itself into something new."
"I never heard that, and I never miss intelligence. So he wants to be Mandalore?"
"No. They say he wants you to be Mandalore."
"Then he can come and tell me himself, whoever he is." The name Kadika told Fett something. The Mandoa suffix Ika made it a child's name, a diminutive of the name Kad. Fett suspected that a Mandalorian who still had a childhood nickname and seemed confident to wear it almost as a badge would be anything but little. In the past, he'd hunted several big, dangerous targets with trivial names that belied their muscle and firepower. They'd seemed to bask in the irony. He'd killed them anyway, but they'd been a challenge. A professional took no chances and never underestimated the task at hand. Fett added Kadika to the list of potential quarry that was big and dangerous until proven otherwise.
"It means little saber," Bevin said helpfully.
"Cute," said Fett. "One more complication, one more mystery. Stick to your priorities, Fett. I'm heading for Corellia now."
"You'll have to beat the blockade, then."
"I will. You still flying gladiators?"
"We are."
"Form up and follow Slave One, then. Let's see if the Alliance remembers that we fought against the Vong for them." Fett decided to stay busy. He needed to find his cure. He needed to see Aelin. And he needed not to dwell on the unhappy past. Corellia's ills would do the job for now. Corellian Blockade, Inner Exclusion Zone. Rogue Squadron maintained formation behind Jason's XJ-7 as the fighters patrolled the exclusion zone around Corellia. It took 5 standard hours to circle the planet at maximum speed. The squadron was flying a cube pattern around a cluster of orbital units that made up a shipyard, probably a less glamorous target than Centerpoint, but a significant one nonetheless. And somewhere aft of his port wing, mistrustful and angry, was Jaina. Maybe it was his instant elevation to colonel. She'd worked for her rank. He could feel her, a bright fire of resentment and anger. Zack was on his starboard side, For a few moments the squadron touched minds in a battle meld, but it didn't feel as united as it once had.
I've lost you, Jaina. In the end, I might lose everyone's love. Maybe even Tenoka. But it has to be done.
Jason shook himself out of regret, and the squadron broke into 6 paired patrols, fanning out into the orbits of the industrial space stations and shipyards, and Centerpoint Station. How close could his squadron get before the Corellians opened fire? Would they fire at all? If the orbital stations didn't have fighter craft embarked, and that was always a possibility, then all they had was their close-in defense systems, the ones they never expected to have to use. Jason switched to the main ops comm link to hear the voice traffic between other squadrons' pilots and forward air control.
"Unarmed maintenance transport inbound for center point, moving to intercept."
"Copy that."
"Visual on the transport. Confirmed unarmed."
"Intercepting now. Range 5 kilometers.
"He's holding course. Let's see who blinks first."
"He's slowing."
"And now you've got company. Corellian fighter range 10 kilometers, moving to transport's position. Fast."
"Got him on scanner. Now visual 2. It was the first test of wills. "Back off, pal."
"Whoa, that was close."
"He's locked onto me."
"Cleared to engage." "He's breaking off. Transport is altering course."
Zack cut into Jason's comlink circuit. It seemed Jason wasn't the only one listening to the chatter.
"Shouldn't we be there?"
"Centerpoint isn't the only game in town. Patience, Zack."
Centerpoint might have been the political focus, but Jason knew the leverage would be in the factories and power stations orbiting Corellian. There was a total of 1 million workers in those orbiters. People with families down on the surface who cared about them.
"Contact, bearing 25x40 from datum."
Zek's XJ-7 blipped on Jason's outboard scanner as it peeled off to investigate. He watched as Zack pinged the vessel with his sensors. The shared display outlined a big, ungainly ship that appeared to be one large tank.
"Okay, profile looks like a replenishment ship. Water bowser and food. Panic over."
"Turn it back, then."
"What?"
"Orders are to turn back all vessels."
Zack's comlink made a slight pop, as if he'd switched it off for a moment.
"But it's just water and catering. It's not industrial or military."
Zack didn't get it sometimes. Jason wondered why he saw angles that other Jedi didn't.
"Those orbiters can only recycle and condense so much water a day. The shortfall has to be topped up."
"You think that's worth doing?"
"Rule of 3.
"What?"
"3 minutes without air, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food. That's how long a humanoid can last. And they're mostly Corellians on those orbiters. The first thing every commander should learn about a siege. There are 10,000 workers in that orbital yard alone, and they're not going home just yet. And they're not going to be resupplied. That makes people sweat."
Zack's comlink popped again. Maybe he was silencing the audio to swear for a moment.
"Who's this shapeshifter? And what has he done with Jason?"
he said sourly.
"Just turn back the bowsers, Zack. I'm not running a popularity contest."
"Very good, sir."
Zack's tone said otherwise, but Jason watched him roll his XJ-7 into a dive and head straight for the water tanker. Jaina's voice was almost a whisper in Jason's comlink.
"Is this policy?"
"Turn back all vessels means turn back all vessels. Do you have a problem with that?"
"Just a humanitarian one."
"It'll bring Corellia to the negotiation table a lot faster without shots being fired."
"Well, you're in command,"
said Jaina, all acid.
"Colonel Solo."
Jason wondered if any other squadron was quite as casual in its attitude to orders as Rogue. He doubted it. It was a long sortie. For the next 3 hours, the squadron harried supply vessels and transports, turning some of them back simply by flying uncomfortably close. Others were more persistent. It took a concussion round, detonated close to their bows, to make them alter their course and head back down to the surface. For once, the XJ-7's business was about being visible, conspicuous, and intimidating.
"We only have to keep this up for a few months,"
Zack said wearily.
"Piece of cake." "Try this for size,"
said Jaina.
"Check your scanner. 3 assault fighters on R6. I think Cousin Thraken is fed up with us already."
Jason looped his XJ-7 into a climb, tracing a complete arc almost without thinking about the maneuver, and found himself looking up through his canopy at the approaching Corellian fighters as they crossed beneath him. Even with G-forces normalized and no sense of orientation, Jason still had a clear sense that he was above them, upside down, just like flying combat missions in a planet's atmosphere. He could see and feel Jaina, and see Zack, flying wide of him, far below, canopies facing him. They had looped in the same plane to come up on the Corellians from the rear, rather than climbing above them. "Did we discuss this move, or did I just think it?" No, it was silent habit reinforced by that twin bond. Jason feared it was the last thing he would ever truly share with his sister, but it was one more pain he had to face. She couldn't follow him on the path he was taking any more than his parents could. He savored the final remnant of true understanding between them, and accelerated into the loop to drop down behind the 3 fighters, right himself, and skim at top speed just meters clear of their canopies. The 3 fighters broke formation and scattered. Without any verbal commands, the 3 Jedi pilots latched onto their individual targets, Jaina and Zack close enough on the tails of theirs to show little eddies of ionized gas on the nose shields of their X-wings. Jason's target seemed to be under the impression that he was chasing Jason. Corellians were excellent pilots, but they weren't Jedi. The marginal difference in reaction speed and orientation made for much bigger gulfs in performance at high speeds. Jason seized that advantage. He let the fighter sit close on his tail for a couple of kilometers, and then plummeted away from it, perfectly aware of his own position in space relative both to it and to Jaina and Zack, who were also locked in their respective games of tag. It was just sparring. This was a game of brinkmanship, a game of maneuver and countermaneuver to test each other's nerve, a game to show that if it came to a shooting match, the Alliance would win. Jason thought this right up to the time he saw the display on his screen blip red with the warning that a Corellian had a missile lock on him. He sensed anything but a bluff.
"You're really going to shoot, aren't you?"
The Corellian fired. Jason didn't feel in danger. He had deflectors, the XJ-7's robust airframe, and his own skills. He also had chaff to deploy. Instinctively, he fired the small decoy in his wake, and it fragmented into pieces that looked, to a missile, very much like a target.
"But if you want a fight, you've found one."
The missile exploded on his tail, and the rain of fragments peppered his hull. The Corellian fighter was still hard behind him, and now he meant business. Jason also knew that his opponent would aim the next missile manually, overriding its smart guidance to thwart more chaff.
"That's what I'd do, anyway."
Jason could have sent the Corellian spiraling harmlessly away by using the Force to tip his wings. He could have stopped his drives dead and left him drifting. But this pilot was one more asset that was ready to take their lives. He and his starfighter had to be removed permanently.
"You started it, my friend."
Jason flipped the XJ-7 90 degrees and shot up vertically as the Corellian disappeared beneath him and overshot. Jason was back on his tail, staring into white engine halos and closing the gap until he was close enough to fire the laser cannon. The starfighter exploded in a ball of white light.
"Jaina? Zack?"
He felt them weaving between the 2 remaining Corellian fighters, and then saw the enemy vessels break and shoot off toward the planet. He didn't think they were retreating. He suspected that they were regrouping to assess the rapid escalation of the conflict. A few hours into the blockade, the shooting had already started.
"Congratulations."
Jaina's voice over the comm link was flat and unemotional, although she didn't feel that way in the Force at all. Jason sensed her as resigned.
"You've made the history books. You fired the opening shot of the real war.
Slave 1. Entering Corellian Exclusion Zone. Outer Cordon.
"Warship Ocean, calling unidentified vessel,"
said the Alliance. Fett listened in silence. Slave 1's scanner profile, presenting the almost undetectable thermal and magnetic signatures of a speeder bike. He was, for all intents and purposes, invisible, unless someone was lucky enough to get a visual on him.
"Identify yourself." "This is Mandalorian vessel Baroya,"
Bevine's voice oozed cheery comradeship.
"Need a hand?" "Why would we need that, Baroya? We've got 2 fleets deployed here. You weren't that choosy when you needed us to fight the Yuuzhan Vong."
Fett prepared for a maneuver that would either get him through the blockade in one piece or solve all his worries about terminal illness, because if he miscalculated, he'd be vaporized along with Slave 1. And so would Myrta Gev, of course.
"Do it,"
Myrta whispered.
"Wait," said Fett, fingers resting on the recessed pad that would punch Slave 1 into hyperspace, just making sure the trajectory is clear.
There was a moment's pause from Ocean. He heard the comm officer swallow.
"Since when has Mandalore been part of the Alliance? You planning to bill us for this?"
"Just being comradely," said Bevine.
"But strictly speaking, we couldn't be part of any alliance even if we wanted to, because—"
Nice diversion, thought Fett. If Bevine started on his theory of Mandalorian statehood, Ocean's comm officer could be pinned down for days. It was now or never. Now! He hit the hyperspace jump control once, and hit it again almost a heartbeat later. In a second, Slave 1 accelerated from a few thousand kilometers per hour to half the speed of light, and then decelerated again. Fett's stomach felt as if it had detached from his body. It was the equivalent of slamming the ship into a rock face, but it punched Slave 1 past the blockade fast enough to show up on a scanner as nothing more than a brief burst of energy. The huge forces made Slave 1 shudder and groan, and Fett found the surface of Corellia looming in his viewscreen. He'd cut it too fine. He couldn't correct the angle of approach before the ship hit atmosphere. He struggled to correct the flight path, slamming on the burners and giving Slave 1's hull one more set of impossible stresses.
"You always this lucky?"
Myrta asked. Her voice was tight and strained. Fett didn't look at her. If she had any sense, she'd be scared rigid. He certainly was. Only idiots didn't feel fear.
"Let's see," he said.
"Fear, yes. But fear never paralyzed him. It just made him sharper." Slave 1 hit the atmosphere, and the hull temperature sensor jumped into the red. The emergency computer kicked in, correcting as best it could, but now it was simply a case of waiting to see if Slave 1's hull and airframe could handle the worst possible re-entry. Myrta, to her credit, was completely silent. Fett wouldn't have blamed her if she had allowed herself a scream or two.
"Have you done this before?"
she asked, voice shaking.
"Once."
"That's encouraging."
Corellia filled Slave 1's viewscreen. It was sobering to note how much of a planet a ship covered when decelerating. They were over Coronet. Fett recognized the city. The big park that was split in two by the speeder highway hadn't changed. The hull sensor had settled back into the yellow zone, and apart from some ominous creaking, Slave 1 had slowed enough for a normal vertical landing on her down jets.
"Coronet ATC to unidentified fire spray. I have you on visual. You're a little big for a speeder bike, aren't you?"
"Slave 1 here," said Fett.
"Oops." He disabled the decoy system and the ship resumed her normal profiles. "Your scanner must be having problems."
"Just can't get the maintenance staff these days. You're cleared to land in the priority bays. Follow the red lights."
"It's nice to feel welcome."
"President Sal Solo is sending a speeder for you."
Slave 1 settled on her dampers, and Myrta let out a breath loud enough for Fett to hear. But he never allowed himself that degree of relief.
One danger had passed, and now he simply moved on to the next one. Holding Sal Solo at arm's length, getting off Corellia again, finding that clone, and getting him to surrender his secrets. And facing Aelin, which suddenly felt more dangerous than anything he'd ever done in his life. Why does a man who's dying anyway worry about crashing? "Come on," he said. "Help me secure the ship. I don't trust Sal Solo any farther than I can spit."
"You're letting me come with you?"
"I'm not letting you sit in Slave One for a few days." Fett set the intruder countermeasures, this time including the self-destruct. He didn't trust anybody, but there was still a scale of distrust, and Sal Solo was up there with the Huts. "Just do as I tell you."
"Is that because I'm useful, or because you want to keep an eye on me?"
"Because I don't want to have to hunt you down and shoot you before you tell me what happened to my wife," he said. He wasn't sure if he said it to shock or because he meant it. He didn't have to care either way. "I did love her. I just didn't know how to be part of a family."
"Do I mean that?"
"Yes, I think I really do." Fett didn't let Myrta see all the codes that turned Slave One into a booby trap for anyone insane enough to try breaking into her. But the girl learned the basic routines fast. By the time they climbed out of the forward hatch, there was an airspeeder waiting on the permacrete strip, and three men in business suits standing in front of it with hopeful expressions. A Corellian stepped forward, dark-haired, young, but with an air of being well into middle age, and held out his hand for a few awkward seconds before realizing Fett wasn't about to shake it.
"Welcome to Coronet, sir," he said. "We represent the three main political parties of the Corellian Assembly. We hope you'll be able to help us."
So Sal Solo had sent his minions. Okay, that was understandable. Fett checked his weapons status in his HUD, just in case things didn't go quite as planned, shoved Myrta in the back of the speeder, and then sat up front with the driver. That appeared to surprise his welcoming committee.
"I'm Der Gedgen, by the way,"
said the young, old Corellian, commendably unfazed.
"It's very good to meet you."
Gedgen would be trouble. Fett could feel it.